Tonight's talk is on equanimity, which is the seventh and culminating, crowning factor for awakening. Good way to think about what equanimity is to think about teaching that the Buddha gave to his young son Rahula. And actually he gave this teaching to Rahula when Rahula was 18 years old and became a monk. It was one of the first teachings that he gave to him after he became a monk. That's a well-known teaching where the Buddha told Rahula to have a mind like the earth. And that mind like the earth being an analogy, if you will, for equanimity. Really, I like the way that Ajahn Jeff translates the passage where he says, be in tune with the earth, to be in tune with the earth. So, you know, we want our mind to be in harmony with the earth, in harmony with the four elements. We want to have those same qualities, or we have those qualities, to be connected with those qualities that the earth has. Begins the teaching by saying, so for when you are developing the meditation in tune with the earth, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions that have arisen will not stay in charge of your mind. Just as when people throw what is unclean or clean on the earth, feces, urine, saliva, pus, or blood, the earth is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted. In the same way, when you are developing meditation in tune with the earth, agreeable and sensory and disagreeable sensory impressions that have arisen will not stay in charge of your mind. And then he does the same things, develop meditation in tune with the water, in tune with fire, in tune with the wind. So when you are developing your meditation, when you're developing your mind, essentially when you're training the mind, develop a mind that's in tune, in harmony, consonant with earth. You know? Agreeable and sensory impressions that have arisen will not stay in charge of your mind when you do that. And he uses the example of, you know, all kinds of unclean things being thrown on the earth, and the earth doesn't complain. The earth isn't horrified. You know, by the same token, you know, when the sun touches down gently on the earth doesn't jump up and down with glee. These sensory impressions, these qualities that are agreeable or disagreeable, aren't in charge of the mind. So develop meditation, develop the mind, train the mind in tune with the earth, with these same qualities of being able to be with what's agreeable and disagreeable without letting those things take charge of our minds. Develop meditation in tune with earth, with water, with fire, with wind. You know, it's particularly cogent and particularly helpful in terms of understanding what equanimity is and understanding equanimity in terms of it being a quality that as human beings we have. When we think of this particular analogy, when we think of this idea of being in tune with the earth, being in tune with water, fire, and wind, it's particularly true because this is what we are. This is what we're composed of. As human beings, we're composed of these same elements. We're composed of earth, water, fire, and wind. And that's what we are. And we have other ideas about what we are. You know, we call those other ideas selves. We usually have a whole panoply of selves. And because we have selves, because we create self. Self is a fabrication, as we talked about at length in our retreat this summer. These fabrications that we create. See, people think, oh, the practice is about not self. Well, there really isn't a permanent self, but we create all these selves, just like the meditator, you know, and the angry person, etc. So we create these selves, and because we do that, when things that are agreeable and disagreeable arise, we take it personally. Why is this happening to me? We take things personally because we're identified with the agreeable and disagreeable things that happen. But in the end, what it comes down to is we're made up of these elements. This is what it is to be a human. This is what it is to have this human experience, is we're made of these elements. So when we open to that, you know, we open to our strength. We open to our strength, you know. Equanimity, the way I like to think about it, is our inner strength. You know, and of course, what we're opening to is our body. Our body. We're opening to our body. Because this is the teaching of the Buddha. The teaching of the Buddha is that everything that's viable and important and pertinent and extraordinary about being a human being is right here in the body. And the way to find happiness is through the body. It's through the body. So we open up to the truth of what it is to be human. It's this human body. And when we do that, we open up to our strength. We open up to our equanimity and all the other factors for awakening. Now, that's something, you know, I mean, meditation, as we always say, is very counterintuitive and countercultural, because what the culture is doing is going away from the body, away from the body, away from the body. You know, and it's what a lot of people do in meditation, or as they take up a meditation practice, you know, they either don't make that deep effort to be in tune with the body, or they use the meditation to develop out-of-body experiences, or they only go so far and they don't look for happiness and goodness within the body, so they sort of have to manufacture it somewhere else. Let's make a fancy meditation center or whatever. But I digress. So, this quality of equanimity, you know, is this inherent capacity that we have that has to be developed to stay on the object, to stay centered in all circumstances. So we develop mindfulness we practice directed thought, we put the attention on the object, the breath and then the body, and then we analyze, evaluate the breath and the body, see where there's dis-ease, learn to put the dis-ease to the side, see where there's ease, cultivate the ease. We make the effort to do that, and then rapture begins to arise in pleasure, which, you know, and that's of course the full body experience, because we're in the full body, and rapture and pleasure arises. And once rapture and pleasure arises, then, you know, we're in a position to be able to stay in the body. I mean, the Buddha said he couldn't stay in the body until he could cultivate that internal pleasure. I mean, that's just what it is to be human, you know? We all have a necessity to experience pleasure. If you don't experience it in the body, he said, you're gonna go looking for it somewhere else. Same thing that guy Freud said more than 2,000 years later. So as you develop that rapture, then you're able to stay in the body. You're able to stay present, tranquility. You're even able to deepen in more into your experience, and that's when concentration begins to really manifest, the ability to stay on the object. And as you practice and practice and practice and practice and practice, you know, that capacity, that concentration gets really stronger. The ability to stay on the breath gets really even stronger, mostly through repetition, right? Staying with it, staying with it, staying with it. I mean, the Buddha said the number one cause for the arising of equanimity is continuous mindfulness. You know, you stay with the breath and in the body and all postures. You know? So as you begin to develop that kind of capacity to stay on the breath, then you're able to stay on the breath and with the body in all circumstances when things are agreeable and disagreeable. So this is equanimity, the capacity to stay on the object, to stay centered, to stay even-tempered when things are agreeable, pleasant. Our day is made up of certain pleasant experiences. For a lot of people, they get carried away by pleasant experiences. They chase after, you know, and our days are made of disagreeable experiences too. And a lot of people, we rebel against the disagreeable experiences. But when you have equanimity, you don't chase after the agreeable and rebel against the disagreeable. You just stay centered. You just stay centered. Another way to think about agreeable and disagreeable experiences is to think of the eight vicissitudes. You know, that our human experience is made up of pleasure and pain. Pleasure and pain. So when there's pain, we're able to stay centered. Really important. Really important. See this with a lot of people in our group who over the last year who have had illnesses, you know, and have been able to stay centered and keep that equanimity. And they say, almost to a person, you know, the thing that enables them to stay centered is the strength of their practice, the strength of their, the thing that's able to get them through the experience is their ability to stay centered regardless of what's happening in the body. So we're able to stay on the object when there's pleasure and pain, when there's gain and loss, because our human experience is, you know, a fluctuation between gain and loss. We get stuff, we lose stuff. We get stuff, we lose stuff. And the third set of status and disrepute. I write about this in my book. You know, sometimes I used to think, oh, status and disrepute, that's only for movie stars. You know, and of course you see that with celebrities, right? Because one day they're on the pinnacle and the next day there's something in the paper and they're like totally at the bottom, right? Total disrepute. But you know, we're sort of like that too. I mean, we're just like that not on television, you know? I mean, there's going to be people, you know, we're going to, you know, have status in certain areas and disrepute in others. Or certain people will confer us with status and other people will confer us with disrepute. And then the fourth set, which is close to it, but a, you know, just a little bit of a shade on it, is praise and blame. We're always going to have praise and blame, praise and blame. And regardless of whether we get praised or blamed, we stay center. It's a good one to think about because we tend to get very high when people praise us, and it's one of the ways that we look for happiness in our lives is through praise. A lot of the things that we do is so that we have status and praise. People like us, people say good things about us. You know, we get carried away with that, and you know, our lives become informed by seeking out praise and avoiding blame, you know. Any people pleasers here? You know, doing things so other people will praise you and like what you're doing. Or avoiding blame. Same. All of these are, of course, two sides of one coin. Most coins only have two sides. So when we have equanimity, we're able to stay centered, even tempered. You know, and really, if you think about, you know, what that means is you're able to stay grounded. You're able to stay in the body because when we're chasing after the pleasure and running away from the pain, we get out of the body. We're in aversion, we're in desire, we're in the narrative, we're in, you know, the self-fabrication. When there's equanimity, we're able to stay in the body. You know, there's a sense of ease, there's a sense of well-being, regardless of what the circumstances are. You know, and you know, we have that sense of ease and well-being, which is really important, because when we have that internal ease and well-being, then there's not such a desperation to get the external pleasure, you know, the external praise, or the to avoid the external pain or disrepute or blame. So we're able to stay centered. That's equanimity. We're able to stay to maintain equanimity through sickness, as I just referred to, aging, death, and separation, right? You know, these conditions of human life that it said that we're all subject to. Sickness, aging, death, and separation, as we chanted today. I mean, these are parts of, this is what it is to be human, sickness, aging, death, and separation. For most people, it's really hard to deal with that, you know? And most people in our cultural, you know, inclination with regard to sickness, aging, and death is to push it aside. And, you know, the Buddha's way is not to push it aside, it's to stay centered and to accept and embrace sickness, aging, and death as very elemental components of our human experience. And it's just, that's what it is to be human. We get sick, we age, we die, we get separated, and we have to embrace that. It's only through embracing that we're able to embrace. I mean, that's about embracing the body and what it means to be in this human body, to have that experience of being here. You know, we embrace the truth of sickness, aging, death, and separation. But that's not so easy to do. That's where equanimity comes into play. Human life is tough. Nobody said it's easy. That's why we need equanimity, so that we can stay present, so that we can be in the body, so that we can have our human experience. And of course, our human experience has this extraordinary potential for happiness. And then we're able to stay centered when there's suffering. And, you know, here I'm talking about the suffering that, you know, we cause through our clinging, the suffering that's rooted in aversion and desire. We have that mental suffering, as the Buddha described it, anguish, lamentation, all those things, but we're able to stay centered. So I always say this is one of the things that I really started to notice in my practice over the years as I started to develop better concentration and more equanimity. You know, it was interesting to me because I would, you know, I mean, I'd still go through the suffering, you know, this experience of suffering. You know, and for a long time in my meditation practice, I suffered, and it was, you know, I mean, I suffered and I really suffered, you know, and it was really, I couldn't deal with it. But then I started to work with the Buddha's instructions in terms of developing mindfulness of breathing, the way that he teaches it, the way that we teach it, and started to develop more equanimity, more ability to stay in the body and with the object. You know, and it was kind of an interesting thing because I would still suffer, but, you know, it was like I could stay centered with it. You know, I had equanimity even though I was suffering. And I was like, wow, that's really interesting. You know, I'm miserable and unhappy, but I'm okay with that. You know, there's this quality of being centered, you know, and of course having that quality of duality we talk about a lot, because, you know, the capacity to stay centered and to stay with the object offers us duality. You know, the suffering, maybe I'm feeling the suffering here, it's not all of my human experience. There's also the breath and a place of ease and well-being, and there's a heart and a place of love and compassion. So when we have this quality of equanimity, we have this quality of inner strength. And that's the way I like to put it. And as I said, it really comes from the repetitions. You know, the more we are mindful of the breath in sitting in all postures, the more that we put the mind on the breath and keep the mind on the breath, the more we'll be able to put the mind on the breath and keep the mind on the breath. You know, it's just that repetition. You know, through that, you know, but we want to be able to, you know, do as many reps as we can. That's why we develop evaluation and these other qualities. So when we have equanimity, we have, excuse me, we have, somebody get me a glass of water, I'm out. When we have equanimity, we have inner strength, but equanimity includes more than just inner strength. Equanimity is rooted in wisdom. So equanimity includes this inner strength that comes from our ability to stay with the breath, and it also includes the wisdom that we develop through our practice. So we say equanimity is rooted in insight or in wisdom. And in large part, this wisdom that we connect into, which really, you know, our only way of being able to really connect into that wisdom is to really understand our human experience, which means being in the human body, you know, but the equanimity confers that ability on us. This wisdom, this insight, is in large part the insight into the impermanent nature of our human experience. you know, that our human experience is in flux, and one of the ways this flux or impermanence manifests is in the way our human experience moves from being agreeable to disagreeable to agreeable to disagreeable. That's just the way it is when you're human. You know, we want things, all everything to be agreeable. I say this all the time. The way I used to be, what I thought my goal in life had to be was try to have as many agreeable experiences as I could and avoid as many disagreeable experiences as I could. And, you know, of course, what the truth of our human experience is, you know, it's about 50-50, and there's not much you can do about it. In fact, there's nothing you can do about it. That's the way human experience is. It fluctuates between being agreeable and disagreeable. So that's the kind of insight that we have to develop that allows us to develop equanimity. So human experience will be in flux always between agreeable and disagreeable experience of body and mind, and also external experience of the people and the situations in our lives. Our human experience will always be in flux between pleasure and pain, gain and loss, status and praise, status and disrepute, praise and blame. Our human experience as being impermanent, as I've already said, will, by definition, you know, and we understand that through insight because, you know, we don't really understand it, it will include sickness, aging, death, and separation. And this element of our human experience that we have to also embrace as being true is the truth of our suffering. And I'm not talking about the suffering of sickness, aging, and death. I'm talking about, you know, the suffering that we've created, that we've developed through our holding on to the experiences of body and mind, our clinging, our suffering rooted in aversion and desire, because throughout the course of our lives, we've all engaged in actions that were informed by aversion. We did a lot of stuff that was informed by aversion and a lot of stuff that was informed by desire. We've created a lot of stories and characters, so in other words, we've made a lot of karma. And what that means is that, you know, as we go forward, you know, our karma, you know, the law of karma insinuates that, you know, karma will have repercussive effects when you're taking actions that are informed by desire and aversion, but also into the future. So the truth of our human experience that we have to understand is that we are going to experience the repercussive effects, the suffering, the aversion and desire that we've created through our actions. We're going to continue to experience those things. I mean, I talked about this a lot on the retreat, like, why do I still feel angry? Why do I still feel anxiety? You know, not only do I still feel anger, but sometimes I cling to it too, because there's a lot of karma that we've created, and I'll probably do that for the rest of my life based on the amount of karma I've created, you know? And anxiety and fear and desire will continue to arise, and I'll continue to cling to it. Now, we can cling to it less and less, and as we cling to it less and less and act out on it less and less, that suffering will, those seeds of suffering that we've thrown ahead of us will be less and less. But this is the truth of our human experience, the truth of our karma. You know, we talk about this a lot, right? Talk about this a lot. You know, people are really, you know, suffering in their lives. You know, they're going through a challenge in terms of, you know, aversion, desire, anguish, anxiety, whatever, and, you know, or just the ways that they relate to themselves, if it's through judgment, or the ways that they relate to the people in their lives. You know, and it's really hard to change that. You know, and to some extent, you know, we're going to have to pay those karmic debts. So we have to have compassion for ourselves, right? How many times over the years have you heard me say, have compassion for yourself, that's your karma. And you sit down telling people in the beginner's class that I just finished, you know, why is the mind doing all that? That's your karma. So you have to have some compassion for yourself. Everything you thought in that meditation just didn't spring to your mind. chances are, if you could probably trace it. I mean, the Buddha said it's so complicated that you can't trace it back to its source. You know, the classic equanimity phrase that we often repeat and say if we're having problems with somebody who's difficult, you know, in your life, somebody, a person who's disagreeable, you know, the classic phrase is, you know, to understand that all beings are owners of their karma, their happiness is dependent upon their actions, not upon our wishes for them. And we wish they would be a certain way, you know, and as long as we do that, we're going to suffer because their happiness is dependent on their actions. You know, they're acting in a certain way based on the actions that they've taken before, and they'll continue to do that. It's also true that our actions, you know, are based on our actions. Our, you know, we're the owners of our karma, you know, and our happiness is dependent on our actions, not upon our wishes for ourselves. So we may wish that, boy, I really wish I didn't have any anxiety and any anger and all of this stuff. You know, that's wishful thinking, you know? You know, you're the owner of your karma. You've got to own up to it. You've got to own up to it. You know, and that's where equanimity comes into play. As these seeds of karma sprout, you know, that we're able to stay grounded and centered. So we develop this wisdom into the impermanent nature of things, that there are going to be agreeable and disagreeable experiences. There's going to be pleasure and pain, gain and loss, status and disrepute, praise and blame. There's going to be sickness, aging and death. This is the way that it is. This is the way that it is. We're going to experience suffering based on our past karma. This is the way that it is. You know, these insights are key in being a Dharma student. You know? The Buddha said you have to develop the Dharma eye, that when you look at your experience, you see and understand that it's impermanent, it's part of a process of change that, for the most part, you don't have any control over. So we have to learn that. We have to learn that. I mean, I didn't really know that until I came here and heard the teachings. You know, and then you have to reflect on it. You have to think about it. And then you have to look and see, look and see. I mean, I talked about that in the sitting. Can you see how your experience in the sitting, you know, has been an experience of pleasure and pain? Can you see that? I mean, that's what we're doing when we're looking at the breath, right? Ease and dis-ease. Experience of the sitting, pleasure and pain. That's the way it is. You try to change that in the meditation, you're screwed. Screwed. You can't change that. What you can do is develop a skillful relationship to it. Have equanimity. Okay, this is the way things are. So we look and see, and then eventually, by allowing ourselves and embracing the truth of change, the truth of sickness, aging, and death, the truth of change, you know, really embracing that, we begin to know it in the body. You know, we begin to know the truth of our bodily experience, you know? It's like most people don't know the truth of what this is, to be in this body. I mean, that's really what the practice ultimately is all about. It's like we want to know what it is to be in this suit of skin. And once we really know that, you know, we know it in the heart. We know it in the heart. So we develop this inner strength, the ability to keep our attention on the breath. We develop this wisdom, and equanimity begins to flourish. And once you have equanimity, I'll talk about this next week. I mean, you know, to the extent that you have equanimity is the extent really that you're able to, you know, be free. So let's close our eyes for a minute.